Good morning. It's 18 minutes after 8 o'clock. You're listening to Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka, and the sound of some sandhill cranes brought to the station this morning by Hank Lentfer, an author from Gustavus. Good morning, Hank.
Good morning.
And Hank, while we still have that sound fresh in our mind, I wondered if you'd read just a short passage about the sound of cranes from your book, The Faith of Cranes.
Sure, Rob. Beneath sun or moon, storm or calm, in every moment of every day, for over 10 million years, the voice of a sandhill crane is called out somewhere on the planet in a seamless lineage of sound. There is cohesion in the chaotic calls of cranes, an invisible thread binding living beads, stitching the flocks, tying each generation to the next. Cranes talk to their egg-bound chicks with murmurs and clicks. The chicks imprint on the sound. They yearn to follow that voice even before breaking free of the shell. The birds grow, add their high peeps to the throaty calls of the larger flock, and are soon clucking to their own offspring. Our lives, too, are embedded in a rich sea of sounds. While still in the womb, a fetus listens and responds to the muted tones of the world it will soon enter. The rich diversity of sound, music and wind, laughter and bird song, sobs, sea surf, poems and snowfall, stories, crane calls. It guides us through our lives and holds us in place as surely as gravity keeps our feet pinned to the spinning earth. In the absence of sound and story, prisoners, locked in solitary confinement, lose all orientation and quickly tumble toward insanity. The lineage of voices that hold us in place come from the near and far, the furred and feathered, the newly born, and the long dead.
And I'm going to put a little bit more crane audio behind us. You know, one of the first things that... one of my first reactions to reading this book, Hank, was... I was sorry, Sitka is not more on target than the crane flyway. We really only get kind of a stray crane or two. We'll just kind of park here. You know, I think the last one was over on the lawn at Mount Edgecombe Hospital. Just might have just got blown over here and just was resting for a while before picking it on up and heading off to, you know, get on the main route again.
Yeah, when I settled in Gustavus, I had no idea that I had the good fortune to be settling underneath this flyway. And these cranes are a flatland bird migrating through this really steep countryside. So they're delta hoppers. They're coming down the coastline. They're stopping at the Copper River, the Yakutat Delta, and Gustavus is an old, or actually it's a new delta. The river's not on anymore, but it's one of the few wide open flat places. And then from Gustavus, they when the clouds are low, they go through Freshwater Bay, past Hoona, down Tanaki Inlet, and they're on their way to the Stikine. So Juneau doesn't see them, and Sitka doesn't see them.
So, bummer.
Yeah, it is a bummer.
But in a connection that I think is kind of appropriate to the overall theme of your book, when I used to work in Wyoming in the summers in college, you know, I'd see when we were out doing hay, we'd see sandhill cranes all the time out alongside our irrigation ditches and things. And it's interesting. Same birds coming all the way up to Alaska. And I get the same feeling. There's other birds that like nest up on the tundra, you know, phalaropes and things that we see in large quantities of here in August that are doing this migration. And it's just, you know, I just feel so stationary. To think about these birds making these huge trips, and we can catch them sort of on, you know, either end of the hemisphere if you know where to look.
So. Yeah, and with all these birds are doing these spectacular migrations, but it's easier to be blind to the movements of the phalaropes or the movement of the dowitchers. It's really hard living in a place like Gustavus to be blind to cranes. People who don't pay attention to any other bird will stop mid-sentence and look up when these guys go over. And if you don't pay attention when these birds fly over, you should take your pulse. They're absolutely captivating. And they grab people's attention everywhere they go. There's crane festivals and celebrations. So this bird can inspire like no other bird.
When I first heard about it, when Carolyn told me that you were going to be coming in and doing this interview, coming to Sitka and doing this reading, I thought, Faith of Cranes, I thought this book would be kind of we've been talking about Richard Nelson a little bit before we went on the air. I thought it would be like Richard Nelson's Heart and Blood, sort of, since you're a biologist, kind of a study of something that, is here in Southeast Alaska that not everybody thinks, a lot about, but there's a lot to know about these birds. But really, I mean, the book is kind of more sort of a memoir than anything, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Cranes is, well, as being so gorgeous, were this great literary tool for me. I'm writing about staying put, and these birds are moving over, and they moved back and forth over the top of me for decades before I ever bothered to really figure out where they were going and follow them south. And I'm just hunkered down in Gustavus and got my little cabin in the woods and trying to turn a blind eye to a lot of the losses associated with the urbanization of America. And these cranes ended up leading me right back to the Central Valley. And the things that I love here in Alaska are not removed from things going on in the Central Valley. So that was a hard lesson the cranes brought me to.
So did you go down to the Central Valley in the course of writing the book, or was that just kind of personal study that you later folded into this very personal story?
No, I was actively writing at the time. I bought the ticket to the Central Valley while my wife was pregnant, and my child coming into the world was really the catalyst for this book. It was the book is my chronicle of a homework assignment to deal with my despair over the loss of wildness and natural beauty, so I wouldn't pass that despair onto my child. And in facing that homework assignment, I said, I got to go. I mean, I've been putting this off because I'm going to see things I don't want to see, but I need to see them. I need to integrate them. I need to deal with them. So I'm hopefully more ready to become a father.
And this idea of passing your sense of despair on, there is a section in the book where you feel that some of this despair was kind of handed to you in a way by a college professor.
Yep, and I think this is pretty common. If you go to school and get a degree in environmental studies or biology, most of what you study is how things are threatened and in jeopardy. And the people that are best able to teach that are ones that are often very heartbroken. And so that gets passed along. So it got passed along by professors. It got passed along by my own father, who came to this state in the early 50s. So he traveled all over and got to know and fall in love with this place when it was wilder than the place that he was watching his son grow up and fall in love with. So he could see heartbreak coming my way before I even felt it.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know, your daughter is 8 years old now, and probably like every parent, you've probably realized she comes to a lot of conclusions on her own without our having to do anything about it. But has she been able to kind of, harmonize the ability to love a place while also recognize that it is imperiled?
Well, she is blessedly still at the age where what takes priority is just loving and being in the place. And she's a joy to be around because she loves our home ground as much as I do at this point in her life. So fortunately, I have been successful to a large degree with my homework assignment, and I'm not passing a lot of that despair on. I'm just happier, and I think I have a healthier perspective than I ever have. And she's really helped bring that out of me. And so we have a joyous relationship that's really focused in reveling in the beauty. We ride a crazy five-wheel bike to school every morning so we can ride on the glaze ice. And we do it every day of the school year. And whatever the weather, whether it's blowing sideways or there's a gorgeous sunrise, part of our morning conversation is what's so gorgeous about the day. And mm-hmm. It's a fantastic way to start any day, and I'm just grateful to have her for a biking companion.
A bike is a great way to notice things. Mm-hmm. I wonder, you know, this book has been out, I guess, since October mm-hmm. now, and you've probably done readings in urban areas, and you probably your audiences are not necessarily, the people who come to listen to you are not necessarily, I don't know, at the same level of peace with the tension there is in the world. Do you find that's the case, that people say, oh, well, Hank, you're up there in Gustavus, you've got your little, you know, you've got your kind of bubble of solitude and wilderness, you know, you don't realize what's really happening down here in Oregon or whatever. Do you find that's the case, that people sometimes give you a little pushback?
You know, not yet. I'm sure it's coming on a number of different fronts. The people that's been most gratifying to interact with are college age folks, and they're the ones that I really held in mind in the writing of this book. In part, I wrote the book I wish I had while I was in college, and it's gratifying to see this resonating with those folks. I spoke with a group of students getting master's degrees in environmental education, and it can so often feel that you can't do enough to change some of the more disturbing trends. And I think that's often true, and you just have to come to terms with that. And that's a very hard thing to come to terms with. It involves some letting go of some precious hopes and dreams sometimes. So it's in those discussions when the book has been able to help some of those folks move a little closer to a hope-filled view of the future, that's most gratifying to me.
Well, it's something that would benefit anybody, you know? It doesn't have to, you don't have to be a college student, I don't think, to get something out of the book. And if you're, you know, our Southeast Alaska audience, I think the book is really going to resonate with them. And even though, you know, I feel very blessed to live where I live, I realize there are pressures in the outside world that we have to cope with. And I found the book is a good tool.
Great.
So you're going to be reading from it tonight. Or tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow. We're both checking our watch calendar. 7 o'clock tomorrow at Kettleson Library. What are you going to be doing today? Just hanging out, enjoying the rain?
Yeah, I'm going to go get some breakfast. I flew in late and woke up just in time for this, and I'm not sure what the rest of the day is going to bring.
Okay, well, some skin hydration for sure. It looks like a pretty wet one out there. Hank Lentfer is an author. He's visiting Sitka from Gustavus. He's written the book Faith of Cranes, Finding Hope and Family in Alaska, and he's going to be reading it tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock in Kettleson, and you're going to sign books, and they'll be on sale there.
Sure, yeah, they'll be for sale there.
All right, Hank, thanks for doing the book, and thanks for coming to Sitka to talk with us about it, and we'll go out with a little bit more audio.
And those audios are by Sitka's Richard Nelson, who captured those and gave them to me.
Who else? But Richard Nelson of Encounters fame. Thanks again, Hank, for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having me in, Rob.